In this episode of the Deming Institute podcast, Wendy Middleton and Dennis Surgent are our guests. We discuss some of the challenges and opportunities in applying the Deming philosophy in government. Hi, I'm Trip Babbitt with the Deming Institute podcast. My guests today are Dennis Surgent and Wendy Middleton. Well, welcome to the show there, Dennis and Wendy.
Hello.
Hi.
Great to have you guys on. Well, I know you both have been working on projects with Michigan Social Services. Why don't we start this conversation by talking a little bit about the projects that you're working on, a little bit about what you guys both are doing now as part of Michigan Social Services.
Okay, I'll start. My name is Wendy Middleton, and I work for the Aging and Adult Services Agency within the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services at the state of Michigan. And I'm the director of the Continual Quality Improvement Division within our office. We've been involved in quality improvement for the past almost 5 years. And we got involved because we were, as an office, we were working with the aging and the disability communities trying to build aging and disability resource centers, a no-wrong-door approach to people getting information about services and programs when they needed long-term supports and services. And we realized during that program development process that we really didn't know a lot about our partners within state government who ran Medicaid-funded long-term supports and services or a variety of other programs. We pretty much knew about our Older Americans Act programs, but we really didn't know a lot about the rest of them. And as a matter of fact, I was happy if I knew who to refer a phone call to over in the larger department or in a different department, because then it was off my desk and I didn't have to worry about it anymore. So we decided to get everybody together in a room to talk about the fact that we did not know each other very well, and that was a barrier to us building this aging and disability resource center concept out in the world. So we invited people from as many of the different programs as we could. We did not let them clump and sit at tables with their familiar people that they worked with. And so we mixed them up, and then we gave them a scenario, which was an actual scenario from the Aging Network, which was an older adult woman who had an adult child with a developmental disability, and they had lots of service needs, and they had a cat. And so we said to the table, how do we help this family? And so at my table, the conversation went something like this. Well, it sounds like they have housing needs. So you guys at MRS, you guys handle housing, right? And the person from MRS, which is Michigan Rehabilitation Services, said, no, we help people get employment. And it was like, oh, well, is there anybody here at the table from MSHDA, the Michigan State Housing Development Authority? No, there's nobody here from, you know, from that agency. And so it's like, well, gosh, where do we start? Do we start with the adult child with disabilities? Do we start with the mom? And so we gave everybody 30 minutes to do that. And at the end of 30 minutes, we had everybody, all the tables debrief and tell us what they found and what they thought was a good way to serve this family. And nobody came up with where should we start, what are the solutions, what can we do here, but everybody knew what to do for the cat. So that was a really powerful experience. And we had leadership from all of these different parts of state government in the room at the same time. And so at that meeting, they signed a charter. We decided we were going to start working on how to coordinate and integrate, you know, these programs and learn more about each other, first of all, so that we could even think about a coherent plan for coordination and integration. So we started working on that. We actually process mapped a couple of different programs and found out, wow, these are all so different. They're not connected, and we need to figure out how to do a better job of this. So one of the things that happened at exactly the same time was we got exposed to Deming's Red Bead experiment. Somebody pulled someone in to do that experiment for us for a big management meeting. And when we saw that, it was like, this is fascinating, and I want to know more about this. And also, we talked to the gentleman that did it, and he said, oh, yeah, there's a whole philosophy. You know, you might want to learn about this. That's how we got connected to Dennis Surgent, who had been a consultant to the project ever since then.
Dennis, what has it been like for you?
It's really kind of fun to think about that the Red Beat experiment was something that the state's good government organization asked me to deliver to four of their sessions. And the session for leadership that Wendy attended was the one that I could not make. And I asked a friend to do that Red Beat experiment for me. And he was quite willing and a willing worker and a willing leader. Jim Manley from the Demmer Center at Michigan State. And though Jim is no longer there, it was a delight to be able to get in contact with Wendy the day after she asked for, so Jim, can you help us? And the Demmer Center couldn't do that, but it was a good referral back to me. And I have to tell you that my involvement with Dr. Deming has been building over the years since 1980. I always thought that there was something special about the way this old man thought as I was first exposed to him in the TV special. And it has taken me a very long time to realize that the connection began long before I heard of Dr. Deming. I worked at Bell Telephone for 28 years in one company or another, and I discovered that Dr. Deming's teacher, in the form of Walter Shewhart, was a source of knowledge that people in the telecom world were using. I learned about control charts from his Shewhart's work. I learned about the Hawthorne effect and the various production lines and control charts that were part of that work. And so Dr. Deming always made sense to me and continues to inform me as I develop a consulting practice.
Okay. And so on this journey that you both are taking, and I assume you two are working together in some fashion, is that correct?
Yes. Yep. Yes.
And so what's that relationship then?
Well, what we did when we realized that we needed to get to know each other better and also try and deal with this, you know, we had not looked at some of these programs and services for 10 to 20 years. And some of them had been embroidered over time with audit findings. Let's plug something in here to, you know, answer that audit finding. And so we decided that we really needed to be educated and we needed to figure out how we were going to move forward. And we grappled with that until we actually had that Red Beat experiment experience and then got introduced to Dennis. And so we had a coordinating council was trying to figure this out, which we turned into what's called the BOLD Council. And that's building options for long-term decision hyphen making so that we could use the D at the end, right? So the BOLD Council. And when you work in state government, acronyms become like an art form, right?
So, yes.
You know, we're pretty proud of that one. And Annette Gomez that works on our team actually calls us the BOLD Council because if we do this right, everybody gets a chance to be old, which is the point, right? You don't want to die young if you don't have to. So anyway, that group was together. At the same time, the feds offered a grant. That whole ADRC, Aging Disability Resource Center thing we were trying to do, the feds came in when we almost had it built and said, well, we're not going to fund that. Sorry. You know, we're just not going to do that. And that's what one of the reasons why we're working toward that. But they offered a one-year planning grant to do that level of coordination and integration at the state level. So we seized upon that grant. I wrote that grant. And we got it from the feds for a year of planning. That allowed us to hire consulting help. Dennis came along, and we started meeting and talking, figuring out, okay, what do we need to do here? One of the first things he did was CQI training for the BOLD Council members while we were trying to figure all this out. And then we value stream mapped 18 long-term supports and services programs and processes that were related. So that was how we plunged into trying to figure some of this stuff out. And we had, you know, 1,800 process steps in those 18 processes and 625. I can't remember anymore.
Well, we had 28% of all of the process steps had some kind of roadblock or issue.
Yep. And so we came up with over 500 ideas for improvement. across those programs.
Okay. And so are these, so this became part of the planning then that you were doing. How much of this then got, did the grant get approved and you guys have been working on this ever since, or? And
well, we had that 1 year planning grant and we completed that. And then we took our findings to the folks, the leadership who had signed the charter for us to start working on this. And so we basically said, we took the data and said, okay, we have 74%, we have 26% waste in all these processes. And this is, you know, billions of dollars being spent on all of these services. Mm-hmm. And so we said to them, here's what we learned, all these processes, all these broken processes, what do you want us to do? And so the leadership, our leadership said, we want you to fix them. And we said, okay, great. Where do you want us to start? Because there are 18 of them. And so they picked Adult Protective Services, the Home Health Program, and My Choice, which is a home and community-based program. But they happened to all be Medicaid programs. They'd all had terrible audits, and we needed to do something. So we put together teams of people to be on a design team, subject matter experts to be on the design teams, and we started training them in how to be a design team and in what we would now consider rudimentary quality improvement methods. And then we just started, they started working and we started supporting them as they were working, starting to work on the ideas for improvement that were identified as the top priorities in each of their programs.
Okay. And so what types of, are these things you're still working on right now? Or are they, are some of them finished, or where are you in the process, I guess?
here's the thing. Instead of using the normal project or process at a time approach, we started training teams full of people about continual quality improvement, the focus being on continual and quality improvement, not just how to implement change. And so we attacked this first 18 set of processes, and in the interim, we, from that point forward, we've had an opportunity to have some really critical improvements made that will help facilitate all of the adults and disabled populations in Michigan that have a need. One example is non-emergency medical transportation. And that was one of the first teams that really took hold. You might be familiar with the forming, storming, and norming phases of team development, and they got through those phases pretty early, and they were a local team and then a state policy team, two separate teams, but they recognized when we brought them together that they could form one team that was more effective. And so they set about changing the policy with improvements, changing the system with improvements. And Wendy, I'm going to let you tell what the advantage was and what the outcome has been so far.
So this team was looking at something called non-emergency medical transportation. This is what people, when people need transportation to the doctor or to the pharmacy or other places, they used to get it in the My Choice program, which is a home and community-based service program where you if you have a nursing home level of care eligibility, you can get nursing home level of care services in your home. And a lot of people love this program because nobody wants to live in a nursing home. If they have a choice, they would rather live at home. So the problem was it took 2 weeks to get an appointment to go see your doctor. So, you know, I've never been in a situation where I can say, I'm going to have a cold in 2 weeks, so I better make that doctor's appointment, right? So it doesn't work that way. So this team did all the research that they could to find out how long is this taking? Is it the same all over the state? You know, and they also have a lot of quality indicators already as part of that program that are having to do with health outcomes. So they proposed a pilot with six of the programs around the state. And what they did was they, instead of it being a state plan service, meaning everybody had to go to this vendor that was the state plan vendor, they made it a service of the My Choice program to see, can we cut that time down? Can we make it faster? Can we make it better? Can we make our customers happier? So the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who pay for this program, let us pilot for 6 months with half of the people who do that program, with the understanding that, you know, unless it was a terrible failure, it would then be implemented with the rest of them within a year. So they did a 6 month pilot, and they were able to cut that 2 week time frame down to 27 minutes, which is unbelievable. And also, there were some weird quirks in the state plan service. Like, if you had someone who's coming into your home and care for you, they couldn't ride with you. They had to follow along behind you in the car, and there were issues with county line problems. They eliminated all of those. So now the person who comes to care for you can actually drive you to the doctor. You can get an appointment made in 27 minutes. So, you know, obviously you call the doctor, you say, I'm ill, I need to come in, let's get you in today or tomorrow. And so they did that pilot, and then it was so successful, and it was so welcomed by customers. I mean, the people who get the services, they loved it. But then it was extended to the whole network of the My Choice program. And then they measured over time to see, you know, are we seeing increases in or not necessarily increase, are we seeing less problems with health issues, are we seeing improved health or less problems? And even after that first year, which essentially was a pilot, was 2 6-month pilots, right, with two different groups of people, they had increased health benefit with over three different indicators, and one of them was falls. I can't remember what they all were.
Hospitalization
was another one. Yeah, it worked, and they could keep the time down, and people's health outcomes were better. So now they have measured it over the second year, and they have found improvements in health indicators over 11 different indicators in 8 different domains, which is amazing. Just a wonderful, wonderful benefit and improvement to people's health. And also the time, they've been able to keep the time down because they don't have to go and call this vendor who can't serve people in under, you know, 2 weeks. So that was our first big success, and that team won an award from the Office of Performance Transformation, and they were honored and very embarrassed to get their pictures taken and put in the newsletter, and you know. But it was our first big success, and that team actually now has set the bar for everybody else to reach because they just continue to progress and progress and progress with additional improvements.
So were you guys, either one of you, directly involved in that effort, or are you more reporting on the outcome of what that team was?
Well, the design teams are supported by Bold Council members who are their coach. Uh-huh. I happen to be the My Choice team's coach. Not that they needed very much help from me, because they really took off. And then when every week, a representative from each of our teams comes to a stand and deliver to talk to the Bold Council and tell us, what PDSAs did you run last week? What did you learn? Are you having any issues or any problems or barriers? Because we help them solve those problems. Well, if they're with upper management, we talk to upper management and get that solved. Also, at the stand and deliver, the teams collaborate with each other and often help them solve problems across the table too. So yeah, we're directly involved with, we put together the teams, we recruit the team members based on, recommendations from people who know the programs. We're always looking for innovators and people who are not afraid of change, and people who, you know, like to do this kind of work, but also who are subject matter experts in whatever the topics are. And so, yeah, the Bold Council designates those teams. We watch over them. We help them. And we celebrate their successes when they have them.
The reason I asked Wendy and Dennis about that question is, There's kind of, whenever I do one of these, I always kind of get the end product that was good. And having done systemic improvement, process improvement, innovation, those types of things before, it's not linear.
Right.
So, and I just want people, there's this expectation already whenever an executive hires either a consultant or somebody in the, you know, continual improvement area. Can you share any that can maybe come to mind of how things that you started and it didn't work, or maybe had trouble getting the people on board, or, you know the stories.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Well, Tripp, there's a couple of things that I I think are important to note. One of them is that the Bold Council learned to look at the influence of one particular initiative on the others. And so we created an affinity digraph early on to identify which programs had the greatest impact on the others. And so we put the team focus and everybody else's focus on how do we help make the system better instead of just making, you know, our particular process better. We also have run into the, I think it's a fairly traditional problem to run into, this focus on preserving the status quo. And the occasional team member who's there for purposes other than a common aim and purpose. And we discovered right away that somebody who doesn't share the aim and purpose of the team really shouldn't be on the team. Mm-hmm. And most notably, we had a person who sent a note to our original subcontractor for the continual quality improvement training. She went outside instead of going inside her organization or inside the kind of shadow organization of the Bold Council. She went outside to say she didn't have the capability of committing to learning, and she didn't want the team to continue, and she wasn't going to be able to make a commitment to follow the team's aim and purpose because she had her own aim and purpose. And so, you know, our reaction to that was, okay, well, then you're not on the team, and if you don't have common aim and purpose with the team, there's really no point in it. And also, if you have no common aim and purpose with wanting to learn about how to do something better, then for now, you're not going to be part of the team, you're not going to learn, and when you're ready, you come on back. And so we just had to recognize that some people are so stuck in the status quo that they need a little more time to absorb the impact of how it could make their whole work life better.
I want to add to that that, you know, state government is a culture all by itself. And one of the ways that you can be promoted within state government, not through the managerial track, is to become a specialist. And so that's different than being an analyst, and they have different levels and you get a higher pay level. So people specialize in the thing. And sometimes they become that job, you know, that it's I am that job. And so we've had a couple of instances where that has happened. But the members on the Bold Council are at a level high enough that they have either the power themselves or they have the relationships with their leaders that they can say, yeah, this is not working out. And the approach we take is, you know, this program or service needs improvement really badly. I mean, we do all the research. We have all the data we need from out in the field where these programs are actually administered and implemented. We know this program is not working. People have been telling us for years that it's not working, and we need to improve it. And just because you think it works, that doesn't mean it works for all the people that either need the services or run the service out in the world. And so the way that we approach it is, you have an opportunity to enhance and improve your job. So please come to the table and we'll work on that together, and we can make this an even better program than what we have right now. And most people respond to that very well, but you have occasional people who don't respond to that well. And in a couple of instances, those folks no longer do that work anymore. And now they have different jobs. But you try really hard to get people to get on board, and you get them the training and provide all the support, but sometimes it just doesn't work. But that doesn't mean that the improvements don't need to happen, and we need to move forward. So we're prepared to do that. The first time we did it was rather difficult. They were unhappy, we were unhappy, and they now, those that didn't retire, because we had a couple of people retire that were of retirement age, and they just decided they didn't want to do this work anymore. The folks that have moved on to different jobs seem happier too. So, you know, it's kind of a win-win for everybody, and it allows us to continue to improve things.
Okay. And are there any of the other things like the non-emergency medical transportation where you've had some movement?
Oh, yes. Okay. We have, when you become Medicaid eligible, financially, you also have to be functionally eligible for Medicaid services. So there's something called a level of care determination process where they figure out, do you have service needs that are at the level of skilled nursing so that you can be part of several different programs? And so that's called the LOCD process. And the LOCD process had been embroidered and tampered with for so long that it was impossible, and like $97 million a month in dollars that should have been going out to providers who are providing these services, all the way from in-home services to nursing home services, were not getting paid. And so angry phone calls and letters were going to the director's office all the time, and it was they tried a couple of times to fix the problem. They didn't have the tools they needed to do it, or the will at whatever levels it was. And so we had a whole design team just for that particular problem. And so they worked on that for 2 years, spent probably the first 8 months in the storming phase for this very reason, because the person who was the specialist working on that, or they were responsible for that program, did not want anything to change. And that was the first time we had to deal with that issue. So in essence, they seem like simple things, but they all have, you know, big complicated IT parts that go with them. But one of the problems was a person's level of care determination. So did you meet it? And what door? There's a whole series of doors that you go through based on your eligibility criteria was assigned to the place where you were getting the services. So the team said, well, this is ridiculous because people move back and forth between these service programs. That code should be with the person so that no matter where they go, it goes. And as long as the person, the provider, uses that code, they can get paid. Because if you moved from one to the other, there was a confusion. And if it didn't happen quickly, then there was no match and then there was no payment. So that was one problem. There were all kinds of matching problems in the IT program. And then there was something called a retrospective payment audit, which turned out after we did all of the research to figure out why are we doing this thing in the first place, it was a misinterpretation of federal law. So we had been doing this program. Yeah, seriously.
It happens a lot.
And until you do that research and validate, is this really a problem? How big a problem is it? Where did it happen? Did it go wrong? Can we figure that out? Because that misinterpretation of federal regulation ended up having a system in place where you would check to see if the person was still eligible. And it was supposed to be, did the paperwork get done right at this time, which was just stretched out into this 5-month review process, and then they would claw back money. I mean, it was just a nightmare. And just one little tiny bit of data that always stuck in my mind was in the aging network, the Home and Community-Based Services My Choice waiver providers, they did some research to find out how much is it costing your staff to redo these assessments and redo this coding and redo this paperwork. And just within 16 area agencies on aging, or I'm sorry, Medicaid waiver providers, it was $30,000 a month just to do all that work because of this broken system. So if you extend that into all the other providers and the 400-plus nursing homes, oh my God, I mean, how much money are we spending?
And don't forget the administrative law judges who handled all the appeals.
Right. So it was just a huge mess. This team developed a beautifully elegant, brand new system to do this all. And then after promises from the IT people that, oh, yes, we can do this. Yes, we can meet your deadlines. Then it was like dead stop. I'm sorry, this is no longer a priority. So that was a big problem for the Bold Council to solve because they had been promised and now suddenly this wasn't going to happen. So we used our relationships with leadership to say, you know, are you still wanting us to make these improvements? And the person who we were dealing with at that time was the chief deputy. And she said, yeah. And we said, okay, because, you know, the team has done a ton of work to get all of this done. She's like, what's going on? Well, here are our problems. Now, at the same time that this was happening, they were hitting this wall, I found a phrase by a quote by Eleanor Roosevelt that said, in essence, don't take a no from someone that doesn't have the authority to say yes. And that became our mantra. We should get T-shirts with that on it, seriously. Because they were getting stuck at sort of a upper middle management level where they really couldn't say yes or no definitively. And then we're not very helpful at first in trying to, you know, get through that. So the Bold Council's job is to reduce those barriers for the team. We went and we met with her, and within 24 hours, they were a go. But the other thing that happened was the vendor for this particular IT system, which is a huge payment system that pays all Medicaid providers, and it's very complicated, they were not treating us like customers. They were treating us, our design team members, like they worked for the vendor, right? Instead of the other way around.
Yeah.
And so the team got very proficient at, no, that's not how it needs to go. This is what we need. And they have basically set the standard now for the whole department in how to prepare the book of, you know, business process and all the things you need to do to hand to a vendor and say, this is what we need it to do. So that has been a huge success. And again, so now the LOCD team has set the bar even higher than the My Choice team for the rest of the teams that are working on things to not take no for an answer and to kind of beat them at their own game, which is be so super prepared that every time they ask, IT people ask a question, you've already got the answer for it and you know what it needs to do. So the skills that are being built in all these design teams with the members is just amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
That's great. These are great stories. I was writing down a few notes as you were talking there, Wendy, and with Dennis chiming in. One of the redesign principles that I use personally is don't break the law. But what that means,
yeah, right.
but what that means is, what is the law? So,
right.
In other words, every time we'd run back and just. To let you know, Wendy and Dennis, I was the chief information officer for the Family and Social Services Administration here in Indiana. So I have some familiarity with some of the things that you're talking about. You guys may have a little bit different names. But one of the things that I wanted to kind of turn to is one of the problems that I saw in government in general, and I'd be curious as to your guys' comments on this, was everything is designed around getting money from the federal government, at least in Indiana. I can't speak for Michigan, and that's why I'm going to ask this question. The design of the services is a lot focused on where that money comes from. And so, you know, Medicaid has to follow certain rules and things mm-hmm. of that sort in order to get it. Now, at the beginning, when you were talking, Wendy gave the story of the, you know, the family with the cat, you know, and the different services that they were in need of. None of the services are designed basically customer into government. It's money into, you know, into the Michigan mm-hmm. government. How are you guys going about that particular issue of? Because everybody says, well, do we have money for that? And I don't know if, again, I'm not sure it's the same in Michigan, but I got to almost believe it is that, you know, oh, how are we going to get the money for that? Oh, we got to follow these rules from the federal government, which sometimes restrict your ability to be able to kind of design things customer in. Are you running into that?
Right.
And if you are, what type of environment are you working in right now? And how do you see that? Are you mitigating that? Are you trying to work with that? How are you going about?
We tell our design teams that it is not their job to figure out the funding or any of that. Their mm-hmm. job is to come. And we haven't mentioned this before, but all of our design teams work from the how do we improve access to whatever there is for people. Okay. Mm-hmm. How do we improve access? How do we make their journey through this process, whatever it is, flow better, you know, without barriers and all that sort of thing. But they are not required to care about how much it costs, care about, you know, what can and can't be done, unless it's something really specific. Like we have a design team right now that's looking at the appeal process for all of the services, managed care or fee-for-service. And there is a federally required appeal process that you have to go through. We're not going to tamper with that. But we can, you know, look at what happens before that, what happens after that. And, you know, this group is actually looking at how could we get an independent review for someone whose services are being turned down or reduced or whatever. We don't really worry about that part as much. And I will say, I think our Medicaid agency is very good at negotiating with CMS on stuff. Mm. We just redesigned the nursing facility transition program. It used to be federally funded and now it's going to be state funded, but you still have to meet, you know, it's still a Medicaid program.
Sure.
And so we designed it the way we needed it to be as a state funded program, as a state plan service. And they were giving us some CMS was giving us some problems on it. And the state basically said, look, this is state money. And yes, some of it comes from you because it's matched and all of that. But we need this to work this way. Our data has shown us if it doesn't work this way, we're going to have a problem here, 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 and here. And they went back and forth over a couple of months, and CMS finally said, okay, we understand your rationale, and it's okay. You know, that's fine. Go ahead and do it. And there was another area in the language on the paperwork you send, you know, the iSpot that you send to CMS to say, here's how we're going to do this program. And it was like a wording change. And it was like, well, this is not a big deal. We can make this wording change. It doesn't change how we're going to do this. It just changes the name of it. So we don't really worry too much about that. So we try and figure out, how can we work with what we have? What do we need to add to it to make it work better? And they don't have to worry too much about, especially funding. That is the job at leadership. We make our best recommendations. They make their best recommendations to the Bold Council. We make our best recommendations to the sponsors who meet once a month. And their job is to remove barriers and help us get these things done. They figure that out. And we haven't been turned down yet. So I think we're doing a pretty good job of that. And as a matter of fact, we have a brand new administration with a new governor and a new director of the department and a few new sponsors, not that many. And it looks like this administration is very favorable toward quality improvement, and especially the director of our new director of the department is very knowledgeable about quality improvement and also very supportive about it. So I think things are going to go even faster and better than maybe before.
Tripp, there's also another aspect that many of the federal programs are very focused on clinical outcomes and on efficiencies. Mm-hmm. And obviously with limited budgets, with finite dollars that are committed to provide service, there is this notion that too often we talk about efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. And the transition and the transformation that we're trying to help people through is to think of effectiveness as the way to have long-term sustainable outcomes. And this shift from efficiency to effectiveness is something that's mirrored in, for example, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement's key measures, key metrics. And so we think of this as, if you improve the quality, you will improve the productivity. This idea comes from Dr. Deming. And it actually works. We have proven it so far in these numerous improvements that have gotten underway, and we continue to use long-term effectiveness, mm-hmm. and effective meaning for the consumer. Mm-hmm. We've built stakeholder feedback into every one of these processes so that we're not just talking about change, but improvement from the eye of the consumer or the customer, or in this case, the taxpayer.
Right. And we also, we talk about, we do measure cost savings in the non-emergency medical transportation improvement effort. There was a $6 million saving
per year,
switching it from. But we don't talk about what that means to us is more people can get service. Right? Not that someone's going to take that $6 million and do something else with it, that you can serve more people with that six. More people can get non-emergency medical transportation services through that program because you have that $6 million that you saved not going through the old system. So that's how we view that, and that's how we always talk about that. And as a matter of fact, sometimes we don't even say it out loud because we're afraid somebody's going to actually try and take it, you know?
Well, there's also an issue that...
Like the legislature. You know?
Yeah. Well, there's also an issue that it took me a couple of years to really even hear about this at the state level, that there are waiting lists for services.
Right.
And if you can reduce the amount of time it takes to satisfy a human need, you can satisfy more people.
Right. Yep. Now, whenever anybody says, we could just improve the service if we had more money, our first question is, have you actually done any process improvement here to make sure that it is as effective and efficient as it can be? You know, so that, have you done that yet? And if they say no, it's like, well, you don't necessarily need more money. You probably need to figure out how to do a better job with this process, and that will save you time and energy and also allow more funding to be pumped into the services. Because, like I said, when we first started this, every one of the 18 processes was really broken. I mean, super broken. Workarounds everywhere. And just, you could see where people plugged in things with no regard to what happens before it or what happens after it. And it's been amazing to be able to just get a smoother process flow in so many of those programs with less steps. It shouldn't take 100 steps to get a service. It really shouldn't.
I was just going to say, we also discovered a mindset that really needed to change, and it can only be changed one person at a time. And we had a fairly high-level person who was arguing against trying to improve a very burdensome process. And their rationale was that their secretary worked in this process, and that secretary didn't have a problem, so therefore it wasn't a problem for everybody else. And this me versus we notion is something that we've really been able to capitalize on. We were delighted to have the Deming Institute come up to Michigan last May, and we did the me versus we seminar with the Deming Institute. And that was an opportunity, I think, for Bill Bellows from the Deming Institute, as well as it was an opportunity for the people on the various design teams. I think we had 41 participants who were able to collaborate together and learn how to think more effectively as the broader WE organization.
And you could see it immediately following that session. Dr. Bellows did such a wonderful job. That immediately following that training, you could see it in people's behavior. It was just amazing. Just watching them, because, you know, we talk to them every week. So when they come in every week, and of course they call and ask for things whenever they need them, but when they would come in and do their stand and deliver, they started talking the language, and it was just a wonderful thing to see, and it really gave our teams a boost in how to get over that sort of self-interest issue, because that can be a very long storming process for a team, depending on how invested the person is on the team who is, you know, not wanting anything to change. But one of our other mantras, we got to get some t-shirts, I swear to God, the status quo is not an option. The status quo is not an option. That's another one of our mantras that we hear from now our team members all the time.
I really captured out of that conversation a lot of things, but was when Dennis was talking about efficiency and effectiveness, and I think this is a very important point to make, especially to kind of emphasize it, because I see so many times, especially in government, where people are going after efficiency and they're working on things that could be designed out completely. And there, that gets to the effectiveness of it, right? So we're in essence doing something better that doesn't need to be there in the first place. And some of this gets into the federal or laws as interpreted. We get into a lot of different areas associated with that. But I just wanted to emphasize that, especially to listeners, you know, if they're looking at government, it's not just efficiency. You got to be effective.
Well, and you know, part of that is the legislature wants everything done tomorrow. You know, and so do administrators a lot of the time. But you can do the wrong thing really, really, really fast over and over and over again. It's not going to improve your process.
No, definitely. Yeah, the push for speed from people that don't understand enough detail is always a huge problem. So let me get to my last question here, which is there anything that you talked about that maybe you'd like to make a clarification on? Or is there anything I didn't ask you about that you wish I would have or you'd like to share?
I mentioned this at one of the one of our CQI academies that Dennis teaches. The teams really need support. You can train them in CQI, and you can give them the tools, but they really need a lot of support, especially in the beginning. So we've worked really hard on improving our onboarding system for design teams, from recruiting to getting into nobody serves on a design team that doesn't go through the training. When we started, that was not the case, and it made it very difficult for half the team that was trained and half the team wasn't trained, you know, to get really organized and do the work together. So we keep refining that. We have certain things that we do when the design team gets together. We work on aim and purpose, and we get them involved in PDSAs as fast as we can. They come up with values to guide their work together. And they come up with ground rules. We do certain things to get them organized and supported so they can start doing the work. And then we coach them at each meeting. We have not decided how many meetings that is yet because each team is different, but we coach them for a certain number of meetings until they're launched, and then we're available to them if they need any help. And I think a lot of process improvement efforts may not be long-term like this. And, you know, we're trying to change complicated change, improve complicated programs and make them better. But there also are those one-shot kind of, let's just change this form, kind of process improvement things which need to be done too. So this work is different than that, and you're forming long-term relationships with people, and people come and go, but the teams need support. They really do. And so we've become, I think, pretty expert at that at this point in time, as far as we know.
Very good. Dennis, any last words?
Yeah, I would like to say, as we have been exposing people to a better way through Dr. Deming's teachings, specifically the respect for individuals, it has been extremely rewarding to see how individual people have begun at different rates to start to transform. Mm-hmm. It has been especially rewarding to see people who struggled at some point get really excited about something like control charts, or to get really excited about getting stakeholder feedback and finding out, what do the customers consider this as, just a change, or do they consider it an improvement? And to see how people are developing not only self-respect, but respect for others, it's a very powerful experience.
Very good. Well, this has been very interesting as far as the conversation, understanding just a little bit about some of the problems associated with, especially the area that you're working in, Medicaid. I applaud you both for the progress that you've made to date, and we appreciate you joining us on Deming Institute podcast to share your story.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tripp.
Thank you for listening to the Deming Institute podcast. Stay updated on the latest blogs, podcasts, programs, and other activities at deming.org.